Blog Talk Radio.
Are you ready to take a bite out of the competition? Are you looking for ideas to make your business better? Welcome to the Core Business Show with Tim Jacquet.
Sponsored by Apple Capital Group.
At the core of every successful business, you'll find people making a difference. And with each episode of the Core Business Show, we talk with those people, examine those ideas, and explore the strategies that make them special. Now, the host of the Core Business Show, Tim Jacquet.
Good morning and welcome to another edition of the Core Business Show. I'm Tim Jacquet, your host. Today I have the pleasure of having Paul Antonori. He's going to talk about his new book that just came out. I know the title of the show we put here is A Modest Proposal to Amend the Constitution, but we're going to talk about his new book, which just been released, I think, matter of fact, last week. Was it, Paul?
That's correct. Just got released.
Okay. And the title of that particular book is called Convention, the Resurrection of the U.S.
Yes, Convention to Resurrect the U.S. Constitution, and it's merely a sequela or updated version of the first book, which was written in 2010, because since the first book was written, a lot of government laws have come out of Congress. We have the Obamacare case that's now pending in the Supreme Court that rumor has it the Supreme Court's going to hand down a ruling next week on the Obamacare constitutionality, whether it conforms to the Commerce Clause of the U.S. Constitution. They're going to make that ruling, I heard, next week. Well, on page 102 of my book, I have an entire section, of course, dedicated to the Obamacare federal law, and I predict it will be ruled unconstitutional, declared unconstitutional. I do the analysis.
Okay, let's back up for a second. If you don't mind, just tell us about yourself and I guess tell us about, you know, how you wrote your first and then how did you do your sequential book, this new book that you've written, then we can dive into the book.
Yeah, certainly. Thank you very much. I'm a trial lawyer. I've been a trial and appellate lawyer for more than 50 years, actually 52 years, both in federal and state courts throughout the United States. I graduated from Georgetown Law School in Washington, D.C. in 1959, and I'm admitted to practice in four states, the state of Florida, state of Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, and the District of Columbia. I got in politics back in 1965 and ran for the office of state attorney for Hillsborough County, Florida, chief prosecuting attorney, and I won, and I served in that office for 4 years, and I had the experience of prosecuting a variety of capital crime cases, big, notorious, sensational cases. And as a defense attorney before that, you know, I had to defend a lot of these cases. So I've been on both sides of the fence. I've been on both sides of the fence. It gives me a good perspective. And but in later years, after doing a lot of prosecuting and defending of criminal cases, murder cases, and whatever, I started specializing in complex civil litigation. And then finally, maritime law. And I never went back to criminal law after that. So for the last 30 years or so, I've just been a civil trial attorney. That's what I am. And I do have a subspecialty in maritime admiralty law. And I've practiced in Boston, Massachusetts for a number of years. I had an office in downtown Boston and an office in downtown Tampa and back and forth and that sort of thing. The book, the reason I wrote the book was because of my concern for the fact that the federal government, what we see now is a spectacle of big government. And by the way, I give it a name, you know, the same name that Thomas Hobbes in his great classic gives the big government. He calls it Leviathan. And so I often refer to big government as Leviathan, the giant, the colossus, whatever you want to call it. But anyway, I make the case in my book for a new constitutional convention. We've never had something like that since the original one in 1787, of course. So for the past 230 years, we've seen this. The government has grown particularly over the last 75 years with spurts because of Franklin D. Roosevelt's New Deal policies. And so in 1937, the Supreme Court handed down a key case and it's all mentioned in my book in great detail, of course. And the balance of government power has actually shifted away from the states and now entrenched in Washington, D.C. So we see the spectacle of big government, which means an oversized federal government that regulates without any constraints, without any fetters, and spends our public monies out of the public treasury with no constraints and with no fetters. And if you ask certain members of, particularly on the liberal side of the aisle, in Congress, you know, does the Constitution authorize this? They'll probably tell you, yeah, they think that it does, and it does not. They're quite wrong in that point of view. And so my book takes them to task. It explains in detail how our Constitution has been corrupted, actually, at the hands of politicians, both in Congress, in the office of the presidency, and by the majority of five black robe justices on the Supreme Court, doing what people commonly know and understand as judicial activism. Now, what does that mean?
What does that mean?
Well, that means when a judge makes a ruling on a case, not by the strict letter of the law, not exactly by what the Constitution says and means, the original meaning, but what he thinks it ought to mean, and what he thinks the ruling ought to be. What we find ourselves in the situation today is social engineering that's going on in the halls of Congress and Washington, D.C. Social engineering by intellectual, so-called intellectual experts, elitists that know best what's best for everybody. They know better than you what kind of light bulb you need to have in your house, you know.
Well, do you think, question real quick, do you think, you know, we noticed this trend with really in the last 12 years since really 2000, 99 with Bush and Kerry election. Did it start during that particular time in this past decade since the rules have changed? Or because really, you know, you have a...
No, not at all. But I will say this, though, in all fairness, I will say this. Both political parties and all the presidents, and you can include the Bushes, but more than them, Richard Nixon, a Republican, okay, but all the presidents, and despite the halcyon years of Ronald Reagan, still Ronald Reagan really, even though we had you know, booming economy and GDP growth rate over 5%, it was wonderful, yeah, but Ronald Reagan in the final analysis did not do anything dramatic or significant to reduce the size of the federal government. And the whole purpose of why I'm calling for a constitutional convention of the people for the first time in 230 years is to amend the four key clauses that I describe meticulously in my book, the Commerce Clause, Spending Clause, Necessary and Proper Clause, and the Supremacy Clause. Those are the four legs on which Leviathan stands, okay? That's where the giant goes that's where the giant feeds, and that's the fountain from which he drinks, in a manner of speaking. Those four clauses.
And those are four clauses, again, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Make sure that they're going to stay with us.
Sure.
You mention them again?
Commerce Clause. The Commerce Clause, that's where the government gets all of its regulatory authority, so-called, to regulate the entire economy from top to bottom. Okay. Now, the Spending Clause is referred to in the Constitution as the General Welfare Clause, because the word spending, you won't find it in the Constitution. So the General Welfare Clause is understood by everybody, politicians, congressmen, the court, the Supreme Court, everybody, as the Spending Clause. So when the government spends $500 million as a donation, you know, to Solyndra Solar Panel Corporation in California, or spends $800 billion for something called TARP, or a stimulus bill, another $400 billion for another stimulus bill, or gives away $50 million to the General Motors plant in Mexico so that they can hire more workers in Mexico. I mean, that's all under the Spending Clause of the U.S. Constitution. But the issue becomes, can they do that legally? Are they acting in an authorized manner? Does the U.S. Constitution really authorize the federal government to spend without limit for whatever it deems necessary and fitting that it wants to spend money for a pork barrel project, an earmarked expenditure that benefits some private company like General Motors, you know, or one of these Wall Street banks or something like. Is the Constitution authorized that? Absolutely not. But here's the problem. And in answer to your first question, no, this didn't come up with just the Bush years. It came up beginning in 1937 with Franklin D. Roosevelt and the New Deal. And he, of course, was an apostle of a British economist named John Maynard Keynes, who believed in massive fiscal federal government intervention into the economy, which, of course, entails regulating the entire economy at the same time, right? So that's what Keynes espoused, and FDR just bought right into that, and there's your New Deal policies, okay? And from that day on, April of 1937, the federal government started growing bigger and bigger and bigger. Now, here's the converse. As the federal government powers in Washington grew bigger and bigger and bigger to the spectacle that we see today, the power, the original power of the states of the Union, the sovereign powers of the states of the Union, protected by the 10th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, diminished conversely and proportionately. As the federal powers grew, the state powers diminished. And now we have an imbalance rather than a healthy balance. The healthy balance is called federalism, the great doctrine of federalism, which is the soul of the U.S. Constitution as designed by the founders, okay? Well, now we have an imbalance where we have top-heavy government at the federal level in Washington, D.C., and the power, sovereign powers of the states have been marginalized. What's the proof of the pudding? What's the best example of that? Okay, the sovereign states are responsible for the health, education, and welfare of their citizenry, of their constituency. When it comes to education, whether it's student loans, or whether it comes to health care, whether it's Medicaid, okay, when it comes to whether a state should have gay marriage or permit abortion and those kinds of issues, that is the responsibility and traditional sovereign power of the states to make those decisions and determinations on behalf of their constituencies. And the laws in those states are going to vary from state to state to state to state. That's the beauty of the United States of America. You can go live in a state that best suits your interests and desires and your way of looking at things, okay? But here comes the federal government and takes these powers from the states, including sticks its nose in education. And Bush is as much to blame as anybody with the No Child Left Behind Act, all right? I mean, here's the federal government, sticks its nose into education. That includes Medicaid, which is unconstitutional. Federal government's got no business at dealing and providing for Medicaid and administering Medicaid or regulating Medicaid. That should be done at the state level, okay? So, all right, what do we want to do? What's the bottom line? We've come full circle here now to the point of beginning. The point of beginning
okay,
is...
Okay, one second real quick. We've got to take a station break real quick. Sure. Sponsor will be mad at us. And we'll come back and... Just you mentioned the four. Were we on number two, spending, and then you were going
yeah,
to
the necessary
the third?
And proper clause and the supremacy
okay.
clause for three and four.
We're going to pick up from that point
okay.
and continue on. So we're going to take a break real quick from our sponsor.
Sure.
Again, we'll be back in about 1 minute.
You're listening to the Core Business Show, sponsored by Apple Capital Group. Apple Capital Group in Jacksonville, Florida is a commercial lender that specializes in asset-based loans, equipment leasing and financing, invoice financing, commercial real estate loans, and asset-based financing in the U.S. and Canada. Apple Capital Group is a direct lender that lends on their private equity investment portfolio. 90% of most loans are decided within 2 hours, and vendor funding within 24 hours after documents are completed with a one-page application. No slow no's, just a quick decision and a fast yes. To get more information about lending from Apple Capital Group, call 866-611-7457. That's 866-611-7457 to speak with one of our loan specialists. Or visit us right now at applecapitalgroup.com. Welcome back to the Core. Once again, here's Tim Jacquet.
We're back. We're talking to Paul. He's talking about his new book regarding the Constitution, the Convention. Paul, I guess we're going to continue with the
sure.
points three and four.
Okay, well, one of the four clauses is the Supremacy Clause. That's in Article 6 of the U.S. Constitution. The reason I want to amend that, because it's been misinterpreted. The Supremacy Clause has been misinterpreted by the progressives, the statists, the radical liberals, in the socialists, et cetera, that populate the halls of Congress, to believe, they wrongly and erroneously believe, that the Supremacy Clause of the U.S. Constitution, as written, you know, entitles the federal government to assert supreme power over all the states, over all things, and over the people, over all things. And it does not. That was not the intention of the Supremacy Clause. So I want to amend the Supremacy Clause to clarify it. Now, why has a Supremacy Clause, how is it wreaking havoc in today's world? Let's talk about a contemporary example of how the Supremacy Clause comes into play, all right? Do you know about the Arizona immigration law? Arizona passed a law called Senate Bill 1070 a couple of years back that deals with the illegal alien border crossers that come into the state of Arizona, and if a policeman has reasonable suspicion, you know, he stops an automobile, he can demand identification from these people if he thinks they're illegal aliens, etc. And so Eric Holder, the Attorney General of the United States, filed a lawsuit against the state of Arizona. Well, in that lawsuit, in which the federal government is trying to invalidate a state law, okay, dealing with local state issues, the federal government invokes, guess what, the Supremacy Clause, and says, you know, the Supremacy Clause says that the federal laws are supreme, the supreme law of the land, okay, and so therefore you, Arizona, and the same thing, by the way, I might add for Alabama, the same thing I might add for South Carolina, and finally the same thing for the state of Utah. You got four states that have passed laws similar to the one Arizona passed. All right, and the federal government is filing suits in all these cases invoking the Supremacy Clause. So there you go. That's one of the clauses we do need to clarify. It was meant, what it was meant to do was to say that if the state passes a law that absolutely contradicts a federal law, so that it's impossible for the federal officials to enforce the federal law, now then the state law gets struck down because it violates the Supremacy Clause. But this clause has been misinterpreted, though, to mean much, much more than just that limited notion. So there you go. We need to amend the Supremacy Clause. The final fourth clause, Tim, is called the Necessary and Proper Clause, often referred to, by the way, the moniker that was put onto it by Alexander Hamilton back in 1787, the moniker still sticks to this day. It's called the Sweeping Clause. Very important to understand how this clause has been used. The Constitution says, you know, Congress can pass any law to carry out the enumerated powers delegated by the Constitution to the federal government, mm-hmm. that Congress can pass any law that it deems necessary and proper to carry out and execute the law, the powers that the Constitution gives to Congress, okay? All right, now, all that means, Tim, the original meaning is that Congress can determine the means or the implements to carry out a law according to the times. For example, if this were the 19th century and foreign trade was being carried on by the great wooden clipper ships, okay? The Cutty Sark, the Sea Witch, the Peking, all the famous clipper ships of history, okay? Then Congress could regulate, you know, clipper ships coming in and out of New York Harbor, you know, or in and out of Baltimore, the Chesapeake, whatever, okay? Well, today, we don't have clipper ships. We have satellite communication. So now, the question is, Congress can regulate by passing, you know, the Federal Communications Act or the Satellite Act. You see, the times have changed. We've become modern technology. We've changed. And so in order to adopt to the times, the Necessary and Proper Clause allows Congress to adopt to changing times by passing laws like the Federal Communications Satellite Act, for example. Now, that's a good example. But the way that clause, Tim, has been misinterpreted and misconstrued by politicians and by the court and by the Supreme Court, by the way, and I can cite you the cases which are described in the book. Now they think that the necessary and proper clause, when you read it, entitles Congress to pass any law on any subject without limit on anything Congress deems fit, necessary, and proper. You see? Now that's craziness. That's craziness. If the necessary and proper clause meant that, and if the founding fathers intended that kind of broad, unlimited meaning, we could have written the Constitution on one page, and the Constitution could have been drafted in one day in Philadelphia. It wouldn't have taken 4 months, which it took, mm-hmm. you know. So there you go. That's ridiculous. And I go, of course, I'm only skimming over the surface here, because in the book I do the analysis in a much more in-depth fashion, explaining the necessary and proper clause, how it's been misconstrued, and how it needs to be amended.
Okay. Now, taking all of those 4 points and look at where we are as a nation today, at both chambers, Congress and the Senate, they can't agree on to just buy toast. How in the world, well, this Congress is not, nothing is going to happen this year.
Yeah.
They barely go, I've never seen a mess like this ever.
I agree.
And I don't think the framers ever thought, I mean, we know they had a lot of heated arguments in order to get this done. It seemed, I don't know if we're going back 250 years, but however, they can't agree to anything. Do you think the Green Party, Tea Party, when they came in, kind of affected our flow of getting things done? Usually there's a sense of compromise. Now you have this other entity that needs to be included and has a voice, and we have all these other issues has been going on. We can't agree on anything. So
I know. You're right. You're 100%
correct. It's a total mess.
You're 100% correct.
And either party is not going to do anything this year. They're going to do minimum in order to do what's going to be the least effect
yeah.
to the election. So at the election is a new ball game. Hopefully
yeah.
people will send a message to Washington and say, hey, you have to get things done. Our economy at stake, you know, anything hiccups in Europe affects, everything affects us. So we need to put our house in order. How do you think they're going to address the issue when it is dealing with commerce itself?
Okay,
I mean, we have this huge deficit.
You,
what can they address to that?
Well, I'll answer that, and I'll say
sure.
this. You have just uttered a mouthful, and you're 100% correct. And I think after the election that you allude to, that we hope it'll be the dawn of a new era and a new way of life in Washington, D.C., and federal politics in Washington, because what we have today is the most vitriolic, mean-spirited politicians populating both the halls of Congress and both houses, and I've never seen anything like it myself, and I've been around for a few years. It's just they stonewall each other. They put their backs to the wall, and they just absolutely will not compromise or give an inch. I mean, this young man, Paul Ryan, he comes up with what I consider a beautiful budget proposal plan. Okay, it's not flawless. It's not perfect. He'd be the first one to tell you it's not perfect. But you know what? It's the most fantastic starter, I mean, for discussion. Put it on the table. Let's start the discussion. Let's compromise. Let's see. You know, you fellows on the other side of the aisle, you don't like my plan? Okay, well then, what can we trim? What can we modify? What can we innovate on here, you see? But instead, a guy like Timothy Geithner, you know, he stonewalls, and when he was asked, he says, I don't like anything about the plan, and I won't vote for any part of that plan. I mean, you know, that kind of vitriolic stonewalling, it's all for politics. It's all to be divisive. It's all to create a divisiveness in America against the haves and the have-nots, to make it look like the Democratic Party, the Liberal Party, is the party of the poor and the uneducated and the aged, the disabled. That's hogwash, okay? They're doing more harm to the middle class, the lower class, than anybody else is, because when they regulate without constraint, as I mentioned, under the Commerce Clause that they've bastardized, and when they spend without constraint under the welfare clause, which they've bastardized, okay, you know who pays the ultimate price? The middle class, the most vulnerable, the middle class and the lower classes, because small businesses and large businesses alike that are heaped on with all these regulations that they have to comply with, they're called compliance costs. Well, guess what? Guess where those additional compliance costs are passed on to? The consumers. In higher prices, and that's why they call all these regulatory compliance costs hidden taxes, okay? So these liberals in Congress that pass, you know, want to tax more and want to regulate more, you know who they're hurting? They're hurting the middle class and the lower class, but they will argue to their dying day if you tell them that, and they say, oh, no, we just want to soak the rich. Oh, really? You mean the job creators, the wealth producers of America, those who advance the gross domestic product, the GDP, because right now it's at a miserable 1.6%. You mean those that make the GDP grow to 5, 6, 7, 8% like it did during the Reagan years? Those are the ones you want to soak? Those are the ones you want to punish? You damned fool. You know, these Occupy protesters, they have no idea. They're clueless what the hell they're occupying or what the hell they're protesting. And
well,
that's
tell
the
us
problem
what the Paul
today.
Ryan bill was all about for the people that don't know.
Tell
us
well,
about
Paul Ryan had a budget plan. He wanted to deal with the fact that what soaks up the oxygen in the federal budget? It's the entitlement programs. We take 40% of the budget is devoted to Medicare, Social Security, and Medicaid. I mean, look, until those three entitlement programs are reformed, we're going to continue to be in a situation of deficit financing, and our national debt's going to keep growing and keep growing. You know what it is today? The national debt actually exceeds the gross domestic product of the nation. Unbelievable. Unbelievable that we would live to see the day where the national debt is in excess of the total gross domestic product of the entire nation. But that is the case today, okay? It grew $5 trillion in the last 3.5 years, okay? And so we've got the spectacle of big government again. That's it. There it is. There's a manifestation of it, okay? And so the Paul Ryan plan actually addressed how to reform Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. These are, you know, let me tell you something. It took a lot of guts to take on those issues, because, you know, people look at Social Security like almost like a religion. Oh, you're not going to take away my Medicare or my Social Security. Well, you know, I have to remind people, before 1965, there was no such thing as Medicare. When I became a lawyer in 1960, we didn't have Medicare, okay? When my children were born, we didn't have Medicare. Congressman Wilbert Mills, under President Lyndon B. Johnson, he's the one that first introduced something called Medicare into Congress, and we've had it since 1965. I mean, America grew and became the most powerful nation on earth without things like Medicaid and Medicare. But you know who was taking care of the poor and the sick and the disabled? The states. The states, not only the states, but the counties and the cities within the states. Right here in Tampa, Florida, we had a city municipal hospital. We had a county hospital for the indigents, for the poor. You know, we had state hospitals. All of a sudden now, you know, in the last few years, decades, since Lyndon B. Johnson, the federal government takes over all this stuff. And, of course, we're paying the piper.
So, you know, taking account now, we're dealing with this beast of 45 years old or 46 years old. Now we have another problem. Now you create this dependency on this particular program. It's like you are giving the baby the bottle. You can't necessarily take it away. So you got to weed them off that. And I think what everybody fear, you have a huge population in America who is starting to retire, the baby boomers. Nobody want to mess with them. Nobody wants to sit there and say, oh, no, we're going to take this away from you. they don't want to deal with the outcry because they will go and vote in droves. How do you take this entitlement program and slowly weed people off of it?
You do it like Paul Ryan started to do it. Yeah, you look at Senator Tom Coburn in the Senate, and he's got a plan, a debt reduction plan. It's very feasible. I mean, again, none of these plans are perfect or flawless. You know, the president organized a debt commission committee called the Debt Commission Study. Alan Simpson, Erskine Bowles, the Simpson-Bowles Commission, and they came up with suggestions, you know, like keep federal spending no more than 21% of GDP. You know, well, today it's like 26% of GDP, all right? But that was the Simpson-Bowles recommendation. Do not exceed 21% of GDP in federal spending to reduce the size of the government. That way the economy would get going, and our GDP growth rate would get going. But, of course, the administration that we have in Washington today has not done that. They did just the opposite. They spend more and they spend more, and they want to tax more, you know. Remember Milton Friedman, the renowned, venerable Milton Friedman, one of the greatest economists America has ever had. And, he advocated, believe it or not, that federal spending should not exceed 11% of GDP, okay? And we've had, you know, great economists of the past, you know. We can name them, and I mention them in my book, besides Milton Friedman, that have advocated the same thing. But today, you know, we've got runaway government, big federal spending, because the federal government has got its nose into everything and tries to regulate everything. So for those baby boomers, the baby boom generation today, for their future, the best thing we could do for them and their children and their posterity is reduce the federal debt because otherwise in 10 years, the annual interest payment alone, I'm going to repeat that, the annual interest payment alone on the federal debt 10 years from now, if we stay on the same path, will be $1 trillion a year. Now, I mean, you can chew and swallow on that one for a while, okay? And it's not me saying that. That's the CBO director saying that. That's Alan Simpson saying that of the Debt Commission, okay? They've said that. Art Laffer, Stephen Moore, all the great minds there that have studied this problem have said that. And that is unbelievable. And that's what we are bequeathing to our children. Imagine our legacy to our children. Yeah, by the time you kids get ready for college, the interest payment of the United States on all the money we have to borrow from India, Japan, Brazil, and China will be $1 trillion a year, okay, unless we reduce the national debt. Hey, we just lost our AAA rating. It wasn't too long ago, and you know why? Because of the ratio of the debt to GDP. That and that alone was the reason why we were downgraded from AAA to AA+. So there you go. I mean, we are definitely, we got a problem in America today. I mean, and not to mention, you know, we're talking economics here, but there's a cultural problem too, this mentality of entitlement. The government owes me a living. No, it does not. You know, that's not the definition of American exceptionalism. American exceptionalism actually occurred in the USA in the after the Industrial Revolution, the turn of the century, and then in the 1920s, again, the really, truly booming years during Presidents Calvin Coolidge and Warren Harding. Those were the boom years, the 1920s of America, the best years in America. I mean, GDP was up more than 8-9%. Can you believe that, GDP growth rate? I mean, in consumer unemployment was below 3%. I mean, those were the boom years, you know.
Absolutely. Paul, yeah. We're going to take another break, and what we're going to do is going to wrap up, talk about your book, and if you can read something in it,
okay,
while we take this one-minute break, and we'll be back in a moment.
Okay. Sure. We're happy.
You're listening to The Core Business Show, sponsored by Apple Capital Group.
Apple Capital Group in Jacksonville, Florida is a commercial lender that specializes in asset-based loans, equipment leasing and financing, invoice financing, commercial real estate loans, and asset-based financing in the U.S. and Canada. Apple Capital Group is a direct lender that lends on their private equity investment portfolio. 90% of most loans are decided within 2 hours, and vendor funding within 24 hours after documents are completed with a one-page application. No slow no's, just a quick decision and a fast yes. To get more information about lending from Apple Capital Group, call 866-611-7457. That's 866-611-7457 to speak with one of our loan specialists. Or visit us right now at applecapitalgroup.com. Welcome back to The Core. Once again, here's Tim Jacquet.
Well, Paul, welcome back to the program real quick. We're talking about the convention to resurrect the U.S. Constitution.
Yes.
I guess give us a closing statement, and then before you do that, try to read something out of the book and give us some last comments.
Absolutely. Well, first I'll remind all of your audience that the book is available on amendusconstitution.com, which is the action website. And any listener that wants to join this action, please go to that website, and you will immediately see on the home page a petition. Fill in the blanks, your name, email, and click submit, and it will go to your state legislature. And if we can get 33 or more states to pass a resolution applying for a constitutional convention, we will have, for the first time in American history, a constitutional convention for the purpose of amending the Constitution, which the book says is the only mechanism that will ever restore constitutional governance in America. And now I will read just a quick passage from Chapter 5, one of the last chapters in the book. It says, "A constitutional convention is the nearest thing to an American revolution that we have in the modern world without force of arms. It is taking charge of one's destiny. It is a powerful means for the people to decide what kind of government they want for themselves and posterity. A convention is people power." Okay? And then I say, if we call a convention, it's like the Americans are saying loud and clear, we are tired of the same worn-out platitudes from phony politicians we elect to office who keep growing the size of government. We are tired of a president who makes matters worse, or a Supreme Court that does nothing to restore the Constitution, and we, the people, have decided to take the bull by the horns and do something earth-shaking to better America, and that is a call for a constitutional convention, which is the enduring solution.
Perfect. And any last comments you'd like to have?
Well, only that I urge everyone who really wants, who is interested in restoring all the traditional culture and principles of America to join this action, sign a petition, get it to your state legislature, call for a constitutional convention, use my website as a reference if you want to, read all the constitutional essays that I have posted. They're for free. Help yourself to them, and you'll enjoy reading them. They're on that website, amendusconstitution.com. And if you really want to have fun, you can get my book through that website, or get it the ebook or Kindle if you want, again, through the website and Amazon.com. And then you'll become informed and educated, and I hope as passionate as I am, because I'm dedicating the rest of whatever remains in my life to see that this thing happens. And I will fight and debate and argue against any constitutional scholar out there who wants to debate me. I will show up any place, any time, to engage in any debate against any constitutional scholar from Harvard or Stanford or Yale or Princeton or anywhere else, okay, that wants to debate me on the feasibility of a constitutional convention, because I've already been debating college law professors, and I'll continue debating, okay, on shows like yours, okay, and I will say to the naysayers who raise fears and myths about, oh, we shouldn't have a Constitutional Convention because we're going to worsen the situation. No, we're not. To those naysayers, we got to shout back to them, hey, fella, you got the wrong idea about the right idea, okay? This is the right idea, and you're too blind to see it. And by the way, I know of a couple of Tea Party people that are afraid to have a Constitutional Convention. They think we're going to go over there and abolish the Bill of Rights. That's such hogwash. That's foolishness. They need to read my book. No, really, they need to read my book. I explained there's a built-in filtration system. It would be impossible to make our Constitution worse. It's all upside. There's no downsides to it. And anyone who suggests that there is doesn't know what they're talking about. They need to read the book.
Perfect. What do you see where we're going to be in 5 years from now?
5 years from now, with the on the contingency that we elect a new type of administration in November, one of a more American conservative type of ideology, I think America is going to be strong again in 5 years. I love this country so passionately that I think if we can just get the right leaders, people that can teach the rest of America by example, a president who can who we want to emulate, who can teach by his example. And you know what I mean by that? Constant reference, constant reverence, expressions of reverence toward the U.S. Constitution. That's our DNA. That's America's DNA. It determines our character. It determines who we are as a people, what kind of people we are and what kind of people we want to be. That's our DNA. So we get a president and we get leaders in Congress that keep referring to the Constitution. I don't even hear Romney referring to the U.S. Constitution. I don't hear the Speaker of the House, John Boehner, referring to when they chastise the law, you know, the Health Care Reform Act, Obama, but why don't they bring up the U.S. Constitution? I, of course the law is going to cost us more money. It's going to increase health costs instead of decreasing. Yeah, we know that. That's fine. The economic metrics are right there. But why don't you invoke, sir, the U.S. Constitution and tell the people of the United States it's unconstitutional? Then we would really listen to you, okay, and do something about repealing that law. So anyway, that's just an example. And I see America 5 years from now, a very much stronger America. But you know what? It's contingent on what happens in November of 2012.
Perfect. Lastly, how do you like to be remembered if it's 100 years from now?
As the man who instigated a movement for a constitutional convention to amend and to restore and reinvigorate the great United States U.S. Constitution. If I could be remembered as that, I will rest in eternity with a smile on my face.
Perfect. Well, Paul, thank you for joining the show. I wish you the very best on your your endeavors, your new book, and we'll see what happens with this amendment. Hopefully it can get done, and I hope people like you can get lead it and bring this nation to this greatness.
Tim, guys like you, sir, and your shows, thank you, because as long as you are giving a voice and people like me a forum and a voice to get this message out, that's what's really going to do it, Tim. So you're the guy to be congratulated, and I thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Paul. Again, this has been another production of Apple Capital's Group's The Core Business Show, and we were with Paul Antonori. He is the author of The Convention, Convention to Resurrect the U.S. Constitution. Everybody, thank you for listening. You can download this episode on iTunes or Blog Talk Radio, on Podcast, Pod Pickle. It's available everywhere. Thank you for listening to the program today. We ask you to, if you do go to iTunes, go ahead and put a review in how you like these particular episodes, if it's meeting your needs or some topic you really want us to cover. So thank you for listening. Everybody have a great day and best wishes to all.
Thank you for listening to The Core Business Show with Tim Jacquet. For a free quote on equipment leasing and financing, visit our website, applecapitalgroup.com. That's applecapitalgroup.com. And fill out the information to receive your free quote. We hope you'll join us for our next episode. And remember, you can always get to the core via iTunes. You'll find all our previous episodes there. Thanks again for listening to The Core Business Show with Tim Jacquet.